Why do more media professionals read iwantmedia.com? iwantmedia.com features reports from industry leaders and media personalities. iwantmedia.com gives you quick access to news, stats, trade orgs, and industry publications, and it's updated daily. Forbes says iwantmedia.com contains everything media professionals need to stay ahead of the game. The Washington Post calls it the source for the serious media geek. Do you get it? If you don't, you should. To sign up for free daily email alerts, visit iwantmedia.com.
Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe.
Which is being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. Visit online at adage.com. The Advertising Show, a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production. We have copywriters out the you-know-what here. It's amazing. It's Ray and Brad with another show for you. This can be a great show, by the way. Tim Arnold out of New York is our guest with us today. Possible 20 is the company, and we're going to tell you more about Tim in just a moment. We also have Jeremy Kent with us just a few moments here, actually. And this is interesting, because last week on the show, we were talking about advertising agencies giving stuff away, in other words, changing the business model to maybe get a little bit better return on their investment. But over in Europe, Jeremy is our European correspondent, there is an issue going on right now about agency fee accountability. And advertisers saying, wait a minute, these guys are charging us way too much, we think. So that's something that he'll talk about. And also, there's a thing about McDonald's being connected with sports in Europe, and it is an issue, and McDonald's is trying to change that by becoming a more healthy and friendly type place as a connection for the sports teams. And we also have a brand new feature this week that we are adding, and someone that we need to welcome to the advertising show. It's Jiang Zhai of the Asian News Desk. We've had the opportunity to take you from Europe, and we go walk around to the other side of the world, and you're going to find out what's going on over there. And we look forward to that. That'll be a little bit later on, but a great report. And what Jiang is talking about is online marketplaces, okay? And basically, there is one over there that is actually destined and poised to be bigger than eBay. eBay not necessarily a player in Asia, so we'll find out a little bit more about that when she is on the show with us. So all in all, a jam-packed show, as if they all aren't, because we like to give you as much information as we possibly can. I love the opportunity to talk about things that cause people to come out and do stuff and respond to marketing efforts and such. And Brad, you're going to like this. Corona Extra and Corona Light Beers have launched their largest summer promotion to date. It is tied to a beach getaway sweepstakes. It kicked off on the 20th of May and is running through July 31st. They basically have put a pop-up beach party in New York's Times Square. The event features 30 tons of sand, ocean sounds, palm trees, volleyball, and other games, beach item giveaways, brand ambassadors, including Real Housewives of New York City, the star Kelly Bensimon, and Olympic volleyball champion, I don't even know how to say this guy's name, Karch Kerali, are part of that. So they're actually covering the event on Sports Nation as well. Isn't that kind of cool? 100 grand prizes, trips to Cancun, 900 Corona Beach getaway prize pack prizes, and a whole bunch more. So if you're in Times Square in New York City, look for that. It's kind of a neat idea. What do you have?
One of the few times you can actually drink legally in Times Square. The other time, of course, it's not really legal, but the New York's finest put up with it, and that's New Year's Eve. We did, my wife and I did New Year's Eve once in Times Square. You got to do it once, and that was many years ago, back when there was only a million or so people that would turn out for that. Anyway, it's interesting, and by the way, you mentioned our Asian report out of Beijing. I wanted to also welcome any new listeners that have come to us through our social media channels, that being Facebook, of course, or Twitter. Follow us at Twitter, on Twitter, I should say, at The Ad Show. And by the way, Tim Arnold, today's guest, possible20.com. Talk about a wild and crazy website. a fun place to go. We'll be plugging that more throughout the interview. But he's got some great stories. We were going to talk to him about the article that he wrote for Advertising Age magazine, CMO Strategy. But I'm going to try to spend a lot more time talking about his career, because he's got a very interesting career, Ray, and a lot of stories to tell. One in particular about partying with the cast of Saturday Night Live, which we'll talk to him about that next segment. But I wanted to mention to you, Ray, that
could be a lot of fun, yeah.
Well, yeah, real quickly, Ray, television continues to dominate the media usage habits of Americans, topping the internet, magazine, newspaper, and radio media in a number of important measures, according to Knowledge Network survey. And here comes the big surprise, a study commissioned by the Television Bureau of Advertising.
Yeah.
So they're saying television continues to dominate media usage. Last week's guest did mention how television usage is up due to our recession that we're in. It's called cheap entertainment. It comes through your cable, and it doesn't cost you anything other than your monthly subscription, unless you catch it through your now paid for rabbit ears.
I don't have any of those. I don't think I want any either, okay? I think it's really interesting, too, and I can understand how television is listening is up a little bit. It is indeed, and as you said, I think it was last week, the cocooning concept. It's like, give me some good news, get me the heck out of here. I have to tell you, what was the show? Chuck. One of our young proteges, and we actually worked with Josh here. And he was on the show, I guess about a week and a half ago, opposite, who's the guy from Quantum Leap? I can't remember his name. Scott Bakula. Scott Bakula. Yeah. But anyway, it's kind of cute to see Josh. Josh is out in L.A. and really going gangbusters on a career as an incredible actor. He's been on Medium, CSI. He was Little Skyler on Heroes, the television show. So, if for his sake, I'm glad. I'm glad that people are still watching, because without that, what would he be doing? Voiceovers.
Yeah, I always thought cocooning, Ray, was just code for depression, and you couldn't get out of bed because the recession and the economy was in a hell of a handbag. So,
well, if you look at the term cocooning, hopefully don't you emerge a better, different. Possibly.
Yeah, you evolve into a butterfly, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just what I want to be. I want to be a butterfly. No, I don't either. Hey, let's before we go too far here, I want to get Jeremy Kent on, our European correspondent. Agency fee accountability? You've got to be kidding. But that's one of the issues he's going to talk about.
Hello, and welcome to the European News Desk. I'm Jeremy Kent. This week, clients attack agency profits, McDonald's farms a new perception, and Google rethinks the direct approach. The latest Paying for Advertising report shows record levels of client dissatisfaction with agency costs and the lack of transparency. The annual report produced by the ISBA highlights that despite a drop in fees, agency margins have remained robust. In fact, for the first time in 13 years, net payment rates to media agencies have risen. It could be that this rise reflects an increase in digital activity and the higher fees associated with it. However, the report suggests that clients increasingly believe that agencies are making too much profit on their business. Consequently, more and more agency contracts now contain an element of performance-related pay. Continued pressure on client budgets and increasing involvement of procurement specialists will see this trend grow in the future. On the plus side, the average time that an agency retains a client for has increased a touch. Looking ahead to 2012, and according to a recent study by Sundance, consumers felt that McDonald's sponsorship of the London 2012 Olympics jarred slightly with them. There appears to be a disconnect between fast food and the ultimate in athletics. McDonald's planned to dispel these negative perceptions with a new UK TV campaign designed to raise awareness of the role British agriculture is playing by providing produce for the Games. By promoting some of its supplier farms, McDonald's hopes to become the marketing department for British farmers. By showing the connection between the athletes' food, the land, and modern farming practices, McDonald's believes that the transparency will resonate with consumers and reposition the company as a relevant sponsor of the Games. At present, the campaign will be in the UK only, but this may change as the Games draw nearer. Finally, as Google's Android outsells the iPhone in the US for the first time, it's a very different story in the UK. When Google launched its Nexus One in January, it ignored the well-established retail channel and opted to sell direct to the consumer from an online store. Conceding that the online approach has not met consumer needs or company expectations, Google has now decided to bring in retail partners. Google believe a real-world presence is required because a lot of customers like to see and feel a phone before buying. They also expect a wide selection of service plans to choose from. In contrast to the Nexus One, Motorola's Droid, which also uses Google's Android operating system, has enjoyed strong sales. From London, this is Jeremy Kent for The Advertising Show.
Out of Europe, that's all we need to know this week here. It's Jeremy Kent. Thanks, Jeremy, for the great reports you give us each and every week here at The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. Tim Arnold is in New York right now, as a matter of fact. Tim is with a company. He's founder, actually, of Possible 20. We'll tell you more about that. But Arnold's 35 years in the advertising communications industry defies definition. So we're going to pass that up. An agency president, multinational board member, a regularly published columnist, a global account leader, a musician who's produced numerous commercial tracks, as well as the first GoDaddy.com Super Bowl TV commercial, director of global business development for the 135-office multinational agency. He founded Possible 20 some 25 years ago to accommodate his consultancy work for agencies, startup businesses, corporations, and entertainment companies. He likes to describe his day job. He is titled one of the most responded to Adweek columns. It's called Making Stuff Happen, and isn't that what it's all about? Tim, I need to read the rest of the bio, but this is only an hour-long show. So with that said, welcome to The Advertising Show.
Well, hi, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, let's get this boring stuff out of the way quick so that we can get into this more interesting stuff about you and the life and times of Tim Arnold in the ad business. As I mentioned, Ad Age CMO strategy article entitled, Is Luxury Dead? Well, maybe not, as you would say, Tim. Your subtitle to that article, Today's Wealthy Consumers Favor Brands That Represent Quality, Aesthetics, and Authenticity. So just the high level, if you would, Tim.
Right.
Luxury is not dead, even in this economic crisis? Tell me more.
Well, actually, my original title for that was Luxury is Dead, or is it? And what is dead for sure are the kind of historical values that have been associated with luxury for so long, like status and, you know, what others think of me because of the Armani suit I've got on and society's expectations and my whole life is about my career. You know, it used to be whoever dies with the most toys wins.
Yeah.
This group of new affluents, which is a very interesting research that I was able to review through a working relationship with Dwell Magazine and their strategy and research group, demonstrates that there's some fairly profound value and attitude shifts in this upper income sector, median household income, 200K, by the way. And these so-called new affluents are now, well, they're part of the world. I mean, while they may or may not have been affected by the economy directly, as bad as some of the rest of us, they're certainly aware of it and want to, you know, demonstrate some kind of responsibility toward it and awareness of it. So this kind of ostentatious, flashy excess purchase habit is gone by the wayside for these people. They're also very much aware of and share concerns with the rest of us about the environment and things like that. So they're very much part of the world. And for these new affluents, instead of status and what others think of me, it's now about what I think and how I express myself and my own personal taste. It's my career is important to me, but it's frankly a means to an end. According to this survey, they have very high priority on their own and their family's health and well-being. It's in a nutshell, it's about quality, not quantity, mm-hmm. anymore. And they also have a concern for more sustainable products, if you will. It used to be, you know, buy it, use it, throw it away, who cares? And now it's not. So I like to call this kind of shift one of that's kind of like from being conspicuous consumers to conscious consumers. And
so, Tim, excuse me a second. I had a chance also, as you mentioned, the new face of affluence study from Dwell Strategy. I had a chance to look at that, and I wanted to get your take. You say and this may be just an opinion that I'm asking for, because I'm not sure that I saw this in the executive summary that I read on the research, and that is kind of looking for an explanation for this shift in attitude about brands among this particular new affluent group that you're talking of. Why the shift? I mean, I guess I could speculate myself, and I understand a choice, a quality of life that a lot of people are making these days, and I think maybe that even preceded the economic crisis that we're in, that people are looking more at a quality of life issue as opposed to it all being around work. But some of these other issues that you bring up with regarding brand choices, you know, social status being so important, certainly during the 2000s, and that being something that's not so important these days, and what other people think and so forth. Why do you think there's been a shift in this attitude?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you think about it, my assumption is that these, by definition, these new affluents did not grow up with this money. You know, this is not old money we're talking about here, and I'm generalizing now, but these are people like us, I assume, that you know, grew up and worked hard and made a decent living, but we grew up with, you know, in my case, good old Midwestern values. And
yeah,
I think just if you think about the roots for these people, that's one thing. And I just think, you know, they're highly educated, median age 45. I mean, these are grown-ups who have come through, you know, 70s and 80s and seen the kind of thing fall apart after the bubble burst, and obviously we're all confronting enormous socioeconomic issues now. And I just think that they're smart enough to make more conscious decisions, more considered decisions, and they really are. I mean, when you look at their favorite brands, I think it really begins to paint a great picture. I mean, of course they're picking brands like BMW and Ralph Lauren and Porsche and Lexus and Chanel and so on and so forth. But what's interesting and yet not so amazing when you think about the values that I was talking about earlier, they also include, the part of the questionnaire was name your favorite brands, and Dwell sorted them out to a group of 75 out of a total of almost 700 that got the most mentions. And so their favorite brand list also includes brands like Crate & Barrel, IKEA, Target, Whole Foods, Levi's, mm-hmm. The Gap, you know, Volkswagen, Craftsman Tools. I mean, so what I think is interesting, and what I talked about at the Integrated Marketing Summit in Minneapolis recently, was what these brands have in common. And I think you begin to see that when they talk about things like quality that are important to them, and price value even, and authenticity, I mean, these are like really interesting kind of core brand values that I think a Porsche and a BMW, frankly, can share with a Target even, or a Room and Board, which is another one of their favorite brands. So that to me represents, you know, my take on that is that there's, first of all, you got to be smart enough to understand what these people are thinking and what their values are now. But then you can say, wait a minute, maybe I never thought of these higher income people as a potential source of revenue. And that for me is where it really gets interesting. And by the way, I think Target is one of the brands that's done a brilliant job of maintaining their base and embracing design as a destination with their expect more, pay less. Not only their advertising, which I think is eye candy,
oh yeah,
by and large, but with things like the Target Design Center at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York. They have multiple programs on their websites that include Dream in Color, and you know, Michael Graves started designing tea kettles for them back in 2000, and since then they've got all kinds of designers in there. And what they've done, and what I think this study, at least another take I have on the study, is that, and Target's a great example, they have democratized design.
Hmm.
I mean, technology has broken down barriers, first of all, that never existed before, and that's one of the main reasons that these new affluents, like the rest of us, feel like they're part of the world now. And so what you find, I mean, there's now you can paint a scenario that says, here comes a guy into Target that makes $350,000 a year, and he's shopping up and down the rows with Joe the plumber.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that all of us can wear Levi's sometimes. You know,
sure.
And all of us can maybe drive a Subaru, which is another favorite brand on the list. And so, you know, you don't want to get too crazy about it, but I think there's a very interesting kind of democratization going on here.
Levi's or Levi's, no matter where you get them, but Target is absolutely a great destination to go find those things as well. I have a problem with a Subaru, but that's all right. It's Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth here on The Advertising Show. Tim Arnold is our guest. He is the founder of Possible 20 out of New York. It's Possible 20. That's possible20.com. We're going to continue our conversation with Tim and, of course, Ray and Brad here in just a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth.
Not so many years ago, tomato soup and cream of tomato were unusual dishes, enjoyed very much, but not very often.
Welcome back. Ray Shillings, Brad Forsyth here with our very special guest out of New York. It is the founder of Possible 20, Tim Arnold. Tim, considering the fact that you are originally from St. Louis and you launched this Buds for You campaign and led the brand to record growth for 10 years, what type of beer do you drink today, Tim?
I drink vodka.
Well,
that's what happens when
you, work on the brand
beer
for 10 years.
And I drink Budweiser. You know.
Yes,
although, the piece before the one that was just published in CMO, I took on InBev a little bit when they were taking over Anheuser-Busch, and I was really, like a lot of other people, I was disappointed. Now I'm afraid some of my head reservations are even coming to the fore in terms of what it looks like from the outside, some of their corporate kind of mindset is it looks like it may be, you know, getting in the way of some of the things that those AB brands have done so well for so long. But that's,
that's
only my observation.
It's got to be a little bit painful, right?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, and for those interested, it's a fascinating research. Dwell, DWELL.com is a great place to go to read up more on that. And as promised, I have got to learn more, and I know Ray and I discussed this before today's show. We've just got to hear more, Tim, about this unbelievable adventure that you had that involves the Saturday Night Live folks and a little post-party after the taping of Saturday Night Live several years ago.
What was this, right place, right time, or what?
No, it was a little more than that. I've been blessed to have some pretty incredible experiences over the years with, you know, big brands with strong budgets and you know, the kind of courage to get behind some pretty brave stuff. We actually repositioned Budweiser back then with the launch of this Bud for You. Believe it or not, Budweiser was kind of a white collar brand before that. You know, big strong association, of course, with Ed McMahon and the Tonight Show and all that stuff. So we I've always been candid about the fact that Miller is the one who discovered blue collar beer drinkers that drank 80% of the beer. But I think, you know, I think history shows that we kind of one-upped him on that with this outright salute to the working man. And what we also learned back then was, and I've never gotten an argument with this, that I think Budweiser was probably the first major brand to really do substantial market segmentation. You know, because we had different issues with each segment. You know, Bud was always number one because they were no worse than pretty much everybody's second choice. But we were not number one, and I don't think any particular segment back then, certainly not young adults, as we called them back then, certainly not blacks, certainly not Hispanics. And so we came up with this idea that we had to do something really outrageous with this, and I think it was the third or fourth year of Saturday Night Live, that, you know, basically said, hey, guys, we're not your old man's beer. We're a beer for you. And we just went outrageous. We you know, our strategy was be irreverent, and we created this campaign called the Taste Buds. Our idea, because they were so unusual and so much skit-like, like Saturday Night Live was, that we thought we might want to hire the show's director, a guy named Dave Wilson. So I turned a 10-minute meeting with Lorne Michaels into like a 3-day hangout with the rehearsals, and you know, and I got to be, you know, acquainted with, if you will, Belushi and Aykroyd and all these guys. And so the night between Saturday night between dress rehearsal and the show, Michael's secretary comes over and says, kind of hemming and hawing, but she says, you know, we usually, the boys have the pass a hat for the beer money for their blues club down there. You know, it's this private thing that Danny, as we call him, and Belushi own.
Yeah.
And she said, I went to John a while ago, and he said basically, screw that, get Arnold to get the beer.
So yeah.
Here comes Belushi. I managed to, you know, and Belushi comes over and says, hey man, that was great. He said, and the Blues Brothers just come out. So he said, and he knew by then that I was a you know, a wannabe blues player. And he said,
right.
I'll get you some records or some albums and blah blah blah. And I looked John Belushi in the eye and I said, the hell with that. Where's the party? And he tells me, and he said, wait, it's just you, right? And I said, yeah, yeah. Because he said, this is really private. And, you know, you've read all the books or people have. You know what,
sure.
What kind of stuff goes on down there. So it's down there. It's right in the Bower. This is when I still lived in St. Louis, of course. And so I don't know if he's stringing me along or what. I showed up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And The bottom line of this experience, of which there was only about 40 people in this, in which you can find at adweek.com, one of my columns, is it's called Live from New York, is at 7 a.m., the only three people left were me and John Belushi and Bill Murray. And you can imagine the kind of state we were all in, and I said, wait a minute, I've got a plane to catch. I got to go home. How the hell, I don't even know where I am or how to get back to my hotel. And they said, Murray says, well, you got to call the Skull Cab Company. I'll never forget it. And I did, and lo and behold, here comes this guy, and he takes me back to the Essex House where Saturday Night Live guests stay, you know, back then.
Yeah.
I woke up about 12 hours later, missed my flight, and, you know, but boy, I had a story. And
you have a story for life to tell. That is a great story. And what a unique and wonderful time to be affiliated and been in contact with those incredibly talented folks at Saturday Night Live.
Just really, you know, once you got past they were just like wise guys like the rest of us, you know, and they just were brilliantly talented, but looking for a great time. And
yeah.
I got to tell you one more piece about that. There was all the guys were there, and the Doobie Brothers were there, and Richard Dreyfuss, who I got in an argument with, and Art Garfunkel, and I see this beautiful woman across the way, and Aykroyd's out there, and they have a big jukebox blasting, and Aykroyd's dancing with some woman. I see this gorgeous young woman across the room, and I go over and I say, I figured I just might as well act like I belong there, you know? So I went over there and I said, hi, I'm Tim Arnold. She says, hi, I'm Amy Irving. And
oh, really?
I said, come on, let's dance. And she said, great. And so we danced about a lot, you know. And finally, and we're like, you know, it looks to me like we're kind of getting along, you know. And I figured out who she was finally. And she finally looks at me, and this is a quote. She said, Tim, she said, we just can't get anything started. And I said,
what?
I mean, I'm just having fun. I mean, I'm married at the time, but I said to her was, well, hey, why not? She said, well, I'm living with this guy now. I said, yeah, who? She said, well, Steven Spielberg, he makes films.
You were dancing with some very special people there, Tim.
Anyway, I probably went on too long.
And that's okay. That's a story from Saturday Night Live as it relates to Tim Arnold, and it's whatever Tim says, okay? The Advertising Show, Ray Shillings, Brad Forsyth, back with another segment with Tim here in just a moment. Our brand new feature, starting with this week's show, the Asian News Desk, and it's called, basically, we're going to talk about an online marketplace in Asia, out of Beijing, that is bigger than eBay. Zhang Jie with us here at the Advertising Show.
Hello, this is Zhang Jie reporting to you from Beijing. Welcome to the Asian News Desk. This week, the world's largest online retailer was created from a partnership between China and Japan. Low attendance worries Shanghai Expo organizers, and industry elites gather in Singapore for the first Asian Advertising and Marketing Congress. Here in Haidian, the Silicon Valley of China, Taobao, a local version of eBay and China's largest B2B and B2C shopping website, recently announced a partnership with Yahoo Japan to expand overseas. The deal will create the world's number one online marketplace, surpassing eBay, which has yet to make a mark here. Through the tie-up, the two merchants will be able to sell products to buyers in each other's markets. And the biggest winners will be Chinese businesses on Taobao, who are now adding an estimated 50 million product listings on Yahoo Japan's shopping site to appeal to customers there. The services launched on June the 1st, with marketing analysts calling this a milestone in the e-retail industry. Let us turn to Shanghai now for more news. It's been more than a month since the World Expo opened its exhibitions on May the 1st. In its first 3 days, a long weekend, the event drew more than 500,000 people, with queues for 3 hours or more in 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Organizers estimated 70 million people will visit the six-month-long event, about 10 times the number of the Beijing Olympics audience. However, mass-savvy Chinese people were quick to calculate that the daily crowd so far is still 50% less than original plan. Officials are said to be handing out free passes to schools and other groups across the country to draw more crowds. Despite the initial disappointment in numbers, Shanghai is still expected to set a new expo record for most attendance. You've heard of the EFIS. Well, now there's the APIS. In a unique event in Singapore over 2 days, 100 of the most effective campaigns in Asia-Pacific were showcased to a large audience of agencies, marketers, and media. This was the first time this annual event was held, with entries submitted from 14 countries in the region. Each of the 100 cases were presented live to a panel of esteemed judges, including marketing heads of Coca-Cola, Nike, and other leading brands. It's like the American Idol for Asian marketing. Final results were not yet available this week, but we will update you when they are. That's all from the Asian News Desk this week. Back to you, Brad and Ray.
On the Advertising Show, Ray Schilling, Brad Forsyth, and our special thanks to our brand new contributor to the Advertising Show, Jang Jay. The Asian News Desk, and we look forward to many, many more great vignettes here as we move throughout the year on the Advertising Show. On the line this weekend with Tim Arnold, who is founder of Possible 20, possible20.com. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
You know, it's too bad that we only have three segments with you, Tim, because you've got such a sundry of topics here that we could chat about, and one in particular that got both Ray and my attention was the fact that I know you were involved and produced the first GoDaddy Super Bowl commercial that aired in Fox, as I recall, and this was post-Janet Jackson and Nipplegate, which probably caused some huge problems for you guys and Clarence. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing, and I think I could probably turn this whole episode into a Harvard case study because the result of all this madness was that Bob Parsons' business at GoDaddy just went through the roof and stayed there. But the Jackson incident, if you will, in combination with, I think, broader things that were going on at the time, like a new Bush-Cheney administration that had a kind of a chilling effect in general, if you will, and then also, it came after, like the year after, I'm sorry to say, my old friends at Budweiser had a Super Bowl commercial on there that featured a farting Clydesdale. And there was other stuff that got a lot of objections raised from viewers. So by the time we want to put GoDaddy on the Super Bowl, the conventional wisdom says everybody needs to cool it, because they're not going to put up with this kind of stuff anymore. Well, we said, you know, to hell with that. My partner, Paul Capelli at the Ad Store, and I, and especially with a client like Parsons, who's a genuine cowboy and hellraiser and savvy, Parsons wants to go on the Super Bowl. He's smart enough to know that the only thing that's missing from his marketing mix is quote, national or international brand awareness, so here we go. And, you know, after a few creative reviews, he looks at Paul and I finally says, you know what, here's what I want. And this is a quote from him that's been published in Adweek. Parsons looked at Paul and I said, all I want in my commercials is a girl with big tits and my name across her chest. And, quote, unquote. And so we were like kind of laughing for a minute, and then we look at him and look at each other, and we say, wait a minute, this guy's serious. So our job at that point became to kind of like save him from himself. And so I think what we did, pretty much going in, but certainly in hindsight, was walk a fine line between like going over the top and just being, you know, cleverly outrageous, if you will, and cast this. The casting sessions were pretty cool, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Come up with Candace Michelle, who turns out to be fabulous and very kind of spontaneous, and a couple of the lines in the commercial were actually hers. but anyway, excuse me, we got the storyboard approved by Fox, and then we hired Brian Buckley, a fabulous director, and so on, and we've committed to nearly a $1 million production, and the night before I'm to go out to L.A., for the shoot, I'm on the train. I get a call myself from the clearance guy at Fox saying, "You know what? We've thought about this more, and we're not gonna go there." He says, "We're not gonna approve this commercial." And so, of course, I hit the roof and demanded explanations and blah blah blah. And you know, so what I knew then was we had to go out there and shoot it in a bunch of different versions, and we did, and we came back, and then they wouldn't approve the original edit of the commercial. For two reasons. One is what they called excess cleavage. And this is from the network that at the time had shows like The Simple Life, where Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie are running around half naked, and a show called North Shore, which they promoted as sun, surf, sand, and sex. And, you know, class shows like Trading Spouses and Temptation Island, and I'm going, wait a minute. You know, I guarantee you that this commercial is going to be at least as good a taste as your own shows, which they didn't like. But anyway, we ended up negotiating through several edits. We got past the excess cleavage, quote-unquote, issue, only to discover when they aired the Super Bowl, of course, they're shooting the sideline cheerleaders who've got much more cleavage on camera than we ever did in our commercial. But the other issue was, you cannot use the following two words in this spot: wardrobe malfunction. The FCC had just levied an enormous fine on CBS for the Janet Jackson incident, which was later canceled. But the air just wasn't in there for this commercial in the view of Fox. So anyway, we got rid of wardrobe malfunction. We edited the commercial. We got it finally approved at the last minute, and it was set to be shown twice. So it airs in the first quarter as scheduled, and started generating what turned out to be 5 million web hits on the GoDaddy site in the next 48 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. I mean, this is good business.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's scheduled to run again in the fourth quarter, and it doesn't. Instead, they're running a promotion for some Snoopy show or something, and the client's calling me and the bells are going off, and I have no clue, but they yanked it.
Wow.
And I know why. I know how that happened now, but they yanked it then, and as a consequence gave us tens of millions of dollars of unpaid brand mention across the media. Because
right.
They not only because of the nature of the commercial, but because it was canceled. I mean, 60 Minutes did a segment on it the following week. It was nuts. And so, for me anyway, it was the kind of ultimate in what broadcast hypocrisy. I mean, it's just here's a network that probably certainly at that point set the low bar for, you know, taste, quote unquote, in programming, telling us that we've got too much cleavage in our commercial, which we never did anyway. And,
Tim, I can't let you get out of here, and I know we're running short, Ray, without telling us now, why was that pulled? Did you get a call from did Fox get a call from somebody higher up, not within that organization, but within the government?
There was I'll put it this way. In the box at the Super Bowl watching the game were a couple of corporate advertising heavyweights, one of whom objected to it just from the pure nature of the commercial. The other one was pissed off because they tried the same thing and couldn't get it clear at all. And the Phil Garascio, the former GM marketing director, who was then NFL's marketing director, was amongst the group, and he caught hell and said, "Yank it! It's not worth it."
Wow.
So, you know, there's that story. But it's sustained. You know, GoDaddy to this day continues to be the dominant shareholder in that sector. And like I said earlier, I think this makes a classic kind of business case, because as crazy as it was, it made great business.
Well, Ray, I think this concludes our time with Tim, unless we've got time for one more question.
Well, I was waiting for another question, so go for it.
I can't. Well, let me ask you, and there's a personal interest in this. I know that you have a great story about trying to negotiate a commercial deal with Sly Stallone. What can you tell us about that?
That was just a momentary blip. I actually met him twice. The first time was on behalf of Budweiser when a handful of us met him at his suite at Caesar's Palace, and we had Paul Newman drove a Bud race car, and we wanted Stallone to get involved with us. So frankly, I've forgotten what the nature of it was, but I was explaining to him our relationship with Newman and the fact that it included his on-camera presence, and we would require that from you too, Sly. And he looks at me and says, "Are we negotiating now?" I said, "No, that's up to somebody else." That never got put together. Then I visited with him with the Burger King marketing director later on, and we wanted to do a program to support autism, because at least one of his children was suffering from that at the time. But, we got halfway through this dialogue, and the guy from Burger King looked at Stallone and said, "You don't really want to do this, do you?" Which is like the ultimate bad way to, try and close a deal. And Stallone said, "Well, if that's all there is to it, I guess not." So that kind of blew up. But that was a couple of little incidents.
You need to write a book one day, actually.
It's going to be called Getting Away With It.
Okay, good. I like that. I'll buy it. It's Tim Arnold, founder of Possible 20, possible20.com, and that is the number 20. Find out more about that. Tim, what a pleasure to speak with you. And we learned a lot of stuff that I'm sure nobody on Earth knew outside of your circle of friends. So we appreciate that.
My pleasure, and I'd be happy to do it again. I got more stories.
Good for you. On the Advertising Show, Ray Shillings, Brad Forsythe. There's more. Hang in there. We'll be right back. Ray and Brad here at the Advertising Show, and a great show. A lot of fun stuff from Tim Arnold out of New York, founder of Possible 20. Next week, we've got, it's the middle of June next week. Unbelievable. DJ Edgerton, CEO of Zamoga. Zamoga. It sounds like a place somewhere far away, doesn't it? Have you ever been to
Zamoga? I think it's a microbrew.
A microbrew, or that, too. Okay. Yeah, that's great. So, this would be a Pan-Asian restaurant. That's what it is. Yeah, Zamoga's, man. The sushi's great. But we'll have DJ on next week here at the Advertising Show. What are you looking at there?
Well, the U.S. Justice Department is said to be examining Apple's tactics in the market for digital music. Apple is facing charges it used its dominant market position to persuade music labels to refuse to give Amazon.com exclusive access to music about to be released. According to Billboard magazine, Ray, this past March, they reported that Amazon was asking music labels to give exclusive rights to sell certain upcoming songs for one day before they went on sale worldwide in exchange for Amazon's promise to include these songs on a promotional portion of their website called MP3's Daily Deal. Now, the magazine reported that representatives of Apple's iTunes were asking the labels not to participate in Amazon's promotion, adding that Apple punished those who did participate by withdrawing marketing support for those songs on iTunes. So if there's any truth to that, and this is all an investigation by the U.S. Justice Department, so we're saying allegedly, but if there's any truth to that, that's a PR nightmare for Apple.
Yeah, more than it could be more, you know, if indeed other things develop as a result of that. Wow. First you have the lost phone, and now you have this going on.
Yeah.
Want to say thanks to Jeremy Kent, that is, and Jiang Jay, our brand new Asian News Desk correspondent. Hope you enjoyed that, and be curious to get your comments on that as well, of what you thought, how we're kind of wrapping the world with opportunity for information. It's really interesting to see what's going on in different corners of the world. Obviously, this is a global show, so it's a natural fit for both Jiang and for Jeremy here at the Advertising Show. It's being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit online at adage.com. The Advertising Show, a Big Radio Midgets production.
Under pressure? Get creative concepts fast. Run a global pitch on openad.net and gain access to a global brain trust of nearly 11,000 advertising and marketing creators from 125 countries. Simply take 15 minutes to fill out our online brief form and we'll take care of the rest. From world-class agencies to the best independents to the brightest freelancers, openad.net global creatives can deliver creative concepts direct to your desktop in a matter of days. Why not save time, energy, and money by quickly sourcing concepts from the world's brightest creative minds? Visit openad.net and see how we're revolutionizing the way ideas are created and traded. It's simple, it's fast, and it's global. Openad.net, the smarter way to create your advertising from the freshest creative minds on the planet. Visit openad.net today to find out more.